We're going to reschedule House Bill 2115. One second here while I confirm. We're going to schedule it for next Wednesday, and as of this time, we're not going to have a meeting of the Health and Human Services Committee on Monday. We don't have enough House bills really to continue on at this point in time, and getting them in today and possibly tomorrow is almost too late to give a proper notice, so we feel we've got committee time to handle these. I'm, in a general practice, not going to have full-blown hearings and testimony on the House bills, and conferring with the House Chair of the Human Resources Committee. I feel that he's held pretty exhaustive hearings on most of these bills and has them in pretty good shape. And so we're not going to plan to just have great big long work sessions and, or public hearings and things on the bills coming over from the House. If anyone has any particular feelings about a bill, and that's one reason we are holding up on 2115, we wanted to examine some possibilities of working with the bill. But as a general rule, unless there's some major concern with it and some concern on the part of the House Chair that there was some needed work on the bills, we're not going to have the in-depth hearings that we had for the Senate bills, and I think that that probably will be the same route that the Senate bills are going to take in the House. We tried to put them in pretty good shape before they headed to the House. We don't have any way near the three-month period of time that we've had to kind of go over the bills now in the Senate in order to go over the House bill, so in 2 or 3 weeks we're going to have to do that work, and so that's kind of going to be the general trend of the course I'm going to set as chair. And by that I don't mean, again, if someone has real concerns, they're certainly welcome to talk to myself or the staff and alert them to those problems, and we will deal with those individually outside of committee and determine the extent of it, and if it's apparent that we need to do some hearing on a bill, I'm not adverse to it, so I'm not just ruling out reasonable problems that might crop up, because I recognize that the legislative process could go a long way sometimes, even putting a bill first through and having the governor's signature on it, wind up with major mistakes of dates and things left out, and those things happen, so if we run into real big things, we will deal with them. And so I guess if everyone wants to go home and celebrate Mother's Day and get here a moment or two later on Monday morning, we'll accommodate you.
Okay.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2079.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2079 be referred to the Senate Committee on Revenue.
Yes.
You want to look at due pass? Or just
no recommendation.
Okay.
With what?
With no recommendation.
With no recommendation.
Okay. Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2079 to the Revenue Committee. Almost said waste me. Without recommendation. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the roll.
Aye.
Senator
Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator
Fisher? Aye. Motion carries. Close the work session on House Bill 2079 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2172. And I would call Aaron Thurber and Edward Johnson. Jeff, you would try to summarize the written testimony and make it as brief as possible, but be appreciated to where you can.
Good
morning, Senator McCutcheon, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Thurber, and I speak for myself. And I thank you for a few minutes of your time. HB 2172, I speak as neutral because I have feelings on both sides of this issue. And I'd like to relate a personal experience that I had with public records here. By background, I am a private investigator, a paralegal, and a legal researcher. And I've also served as family historian and genealogist for the Albert King Thurber, John Lo Butler, and John Calvin Lozell Smith family organizations. A couple of years ago, I was requested by the University of Utah Medical School Neurology Department to assemble as many of my family as I could muster, including extended family members for four generations, to come to the University of Utah Medical Center to conduct a study under the auspices of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. This was a monumental task, I might say. One of my nephews has Charcot-Marie tooth disease, which is a genetic neuromuscular condition, and the association wanted to track this illness to see if there were other members of the family who were carriers and to locate possibly the origin of this illness. And the only way to determine who the carriers were is a genetic screening and also an electromyogram and neuroconduction study. And luckily, the study determined that that boy was the only one who had it, although other members of the family had characteristics that might indicate the illness. I attempted to use the Oregon archives for this research, but was prohibited by the 100-year and 50-year rule, which is in line 22 and 23. Thus, I had to turn to other resources, namely the Family History Library of the LDS Church, to conduct my research. This caused a delay in the work that could have been done had I had access to the records with the Oregon Archives. Now, this rule was designed to protect the interest of Oregon's founding fathers, and surely there have been people who have come to Oregon since that time and have made significant contributions to Oregon's history and to their economy. And their history also deserves study. I would recommend that the 100-year and 50-year rules be eliminated from the existing law. Moreover, in my work as a private investigator and genealogical researcher, family connections must sometimes be established. There is a question of right to privacy, which was addressed by the Attorney General in one of his opinions, and which instigated this bill, the need for this bill. Hospitals provide parents at the time they come in for the birth of a child a form which they can sign, giving permission for publishing their information in the newspapers. And when they sign this form, they voluntarily give up their right to privacy, and thus their names are published in the newspapers. Marriage covenants are a binding and legal contract, and as such are perfected by registering with the county recorder. And I do not understand why they should be kept secret. They should be ashamed of being married. And they should be open for legitimate for research purposes. And if people have children, they should face the music that they have those children. These issues should be addressed. And as far as I can tell, are not addressed in the bill as presently constituted, and I have not been able to see the amendments to the bill because I just heard about it last night, but it was going to be heard today. And I would like to see additional wording put into the bill, perhaps in a section 18, on page 5, line after line 32,
which would permit access to the records for private investigators, for service of legal process and discovery, and for family genealogical research. Thank you.
Where again did you say you wanted that put on the page?
It'll be on page 5, after line 32.
Oh, you would make a subparagraph head. Now, would you read that again for us, or do you have a copy of it that we can?
Well, I can read just an idea here. I just penciled it in. Private investigators, come up for a service of legal process and discovery, and comma, and family / genealogical research.
Well, this actually section is a section of definitions, and I don't know if that would be proper to place
to
put.
Okay. Private investigators, comma, for legal, I'm sorry, for service of legal process, comma, and discovery, comma, and family / genealogical research.
No, that's not a definition. That would be an exclusion to the safeguard. I'm not a creator. Didn't we have a bill for us to the Senate? That's right. Why don't we go ahead with your testimony here, and we'll have the members touch, take a little bit on this.
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, I'm Edward Johnson, State Registrar for Vital Records in the Oregon Health Division. I'm here to provide information regarding provisions of House Bill 2172. I have my written testimony, which gives in much detail the provisions in House Bill 2172. I won't read all of that. Basically, in the last legislative session, there was we made some corrections to the vital records law, and some of those corrections caused some problems with access to records in the county clerk's office of marriage records, and we're trying to change those provisions so that the marriage records that are available in county clerk's offices aren't under the control of vital records statutes, but they're open and available. This is supported by the County Clerk's Association. It also makes some other changes to allowing indices of marriage, divorce, and death records open and available to the public, and clarifying the language in our statute that allows that the subject of a record can also get a copy of their own record. That was a sort of an oversight in our previous language. There's a couple other minor modifications to our statute that are in the bill that I put in detail in my testimony. If you'd like, I could speak to a few of the other gentleman's questions.
Yes, if you would, please, because it seems to me, in reviewing it in my mind here, briefly, at least, that this opens up the records that he was speaking about to public
knowledge, at least to a certain extent here, and
I think with marriage and divorce records, Chair Fisher, that they are open and available. After the result of this would be that any records held in county clerk's offices would be open and available for access. I think a bit of the previous testimony might have been there might have been some misunderstanding, because the 50-year and 50-year for death, marriage, and divorce records, and 100-year for birth records does not prevent family members from getting those records. It only prevents non-family members from getting those records. And so I'm not sure what experience he had with the Archives Division, but that's what the law says. It specifically says when 100 years have elapsed after the date of birth, or 50 years have elapsed after the date of death, marriage, or dissolution, or divorce, then those become publicly accessible. But they're, in previous language, it talks about that they're open and available to the spouse, child, parent, sibling, or legal guardian of the subject of the record. And that's where we're adding the subject of the record also to that list in this bill. But since the spouse, child, parent, sibling, or legal guardian of the subject of the record and authorized representative of the subject record, and I think that's where they
could be a private investigator too.
Could be if, in fact, they're authorized by the person on the record. If there is are people who might fit in the category of just doing generic research that might have a problem, but that's, we're trying to make the records, specific records, only available to people that have appropriate interest. Mm-hmm.
How did the adoption initiative enter into this? I would provide that. I had never been much aware of a problem trying to search a family record. But an adoptive record was a total different thing, and I understand that, as I'm thinking, that those have been changed or in the process of being changed considerably.
Yes, Chair Fisher, the Measure 58 would, in fact, what happens with an adoption record is the original record and the reports to change that record go into a sealed file, and we create a brand new record. And so the record, the original record that goes in the sealed file, is the one that Measure 58 wanted to open up and make available to people. But currently the statute says that it can only be opened by administrative purposes by my office or by a court order of a court of competent jurisdiction. Measure 58 made that provision so that somebody after they reached the age of 21 could, in fact, get the record. That's still held up in the courts, and we expect that there will be some activity on that in July or so.
Other questions? Did you need to be briefed a little bit on
it? Yeah, I'd appreciate it. I didn't get out of the other committee until 8:30.
Well, I understand. I understand. Out of deference to you, I didn't start the committee until a little later anyway. Not really. Go ahead, Mr. Server.
If I might just add another comment. There are people who are adopted who might also have legitimate medical problems, such as we had our investigation for, and those records should be open for that research purpose also.
Part of the problem we have with amending things and adding too many things into them, we need to make a record change here in order to facilitate the proper workings of the system. And if we load it down with controversial issues, then we lose the entire bill. We don't get what we need to operate in the coming years, and that's why a lot of those things come by separately in a particular bill, and I don't know that I would want to load this down with an issue that might be controversial when it maybe is being largely answered in the process of court decision right at the moment. Did this have an emergency clause?
I don't believe it did.
So if we get some kind of a court proceedings going in the June or July framework, a bill like this wouldn't even go into effect until probably October or November, and depending on the time we get out. And from that standpoint, might be vastly changed and further complicate matters. So I think myself, I probably wouldn't be too interested in urging this particular bill with too many amendments, but I certainly would not be adverse to working in a future session or something to go ahead to have a chance to analyze what comes of the adoption initiative process here in the court proceedings and take a look at that. And by that time, we'd also know how this is working and whether it's doing its job too. Is there further questions?
I'm fine.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2072.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2172 to the House with a 2-4 with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Castillo has moved House Bill 2172 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Question? Hearing none, will clerk call the roll?
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Mente?
Aye.
Senator?
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier?
I'll
carry it. Okay. Senator Castillo will carry the House Bill 2172. Close the work session on House Bill 2172A and open a public hearing on House Bill 3000. To Davidson, Maggie Donius, Gene Falls, and Joe Bell, if we can, is there an extra chair up here available?
Sure enough, we can all do it.
All right. If we can, we'll just, I see we are keeping somebody else here. Well, yeah, just take maybe three, and then we'll take three and two, and that'll.
Yeah, yeah. Chairman Senator Fisher, Vice Chairman Senator Shields, who's over here, and members of the Senate Health and Human Resources Committee. Good morning. My name is Sue Davidson. I am a representative of the Oregon Council of Clinical Nurse Specialists and the 150 clinical specialists in Oregon, and I also teach graduate nursing students to become clinical specialists, and I practice as a clinical specialist for people who have diabetes. My testimony today will focus on three things about HB 3000, why we are here again, why statute and administrative rule are needed to describe the scope of CMS practice, and how this bill will solve some problems that still exist as CMS's attempt to practice in this state. Our story actually began in rural Oregon in 1991 when Rita Monahan, a gerontological CMS and faculty member of OHSU School of Nursing in Midland, submitted a claim for reimbursement for her services to the elderly in a long-term care facility. Rita had reason to request reimbursement because at that time, reimbursement for care by a CMS was covered by a federal mandate for underserved rural areas by Medicare. The claim was denied, and after a lot of wrangling, the regional director of Medicare told her, "Ms. Monahan, it is futile to pursue this. You do not exist. There is no such entity as a clinical nurse specialist in Oregon's Nurse Practice Act." Now, this episode was a wake-up call for all clinical specialists in the state. Pursuit of reimbursement was not what motivated us. It was seeing that we were not even on the radar screen in the Nurse Practice Act as advanced practice nurses. And so to rectify this, a group of clinical specialists in the state worked with the Board of Nursing to write a scope of practice statement for ClinSpec. At that time, the only advanced practice nurses with a scope in the Practice Act were nurse practitioners. So we thought that we could tuck under that division of the Nurse Practice Act. However, in 1994, when the task force's work was reviewed by the Board of Nursing Assistant Attorney General, he concluded that the Board of Nursing could not regulate CNSs because their practice differed substantially from that of nurse practitioners and legislative action would be required. By then, it was too late to prepare for the 95 legislative session, so we prepared for the 97 session to shape our message and find a sponsor for our bill. HB 2525 was introduced in 1997 by then Representative Tony Corcoran, received a hearing that died in committee in the 1997 session. In summary, our bill in 97 and HB 3000 before you today has exactly the same intention, enacting a statute which directs the Board of Nursing to create administrative rules describing the practice of clinical nurse specialists. Now, in a very few words, I would like to say something about how clinical specialists and nurse practitioners are similar and how they differ. There is a chart in your packet, we sent a packet to all of you prior to this hearing, which shows the differences between CNSs and nurse practitioners. They share three things together. They're both advanced practice nurses, they are both prepared at the graduate level in nursing, and what they do exceeds the knowledge and competency of the general staff nurse, thus requiring administrative rules regarding their scope of practice. But here, the similarities end. Whereas nurse practitioners provide primary care through diagnosing, treating, and prescribing medications for various diseases, CNSs are master nurses, that is, they provide advanced nursing care. Another provider, be it a physician or a nurse practitioner, has already established the diagnosis and is managing and treating the medical problem or disease. Whereas the nurse practitioner's major customer is the patient and his or her family, CNSs have three interrelated customers, patients and their families, the nursing staff, and the system they work in. By providing nursing care to patients who have unusual, complicated, or complex problems, CNSs teach the nursing staff, as well as caring for those patients, and develop programs that provide practice guidelines for care of patients in a particular area, such as cardiovascular nursing, liver transplant, and so on. You are certainly welcome to observe CNS practice if you wish in worksite visits with some of the clinical specialists at Salem Hospital, which can be arranged through Oregon Nurse Association health policy lobbyists. These differences in practice between CNSs and nurse practitioners are the reason why the assistant AG concluded that the practice of CNSs and NP was different and different administrative rules were needed. Now, two practicing CNSs are going to give testimony regarding the impact of not being in the Practice Act, and what I would like to do is set this up by explaining the problems that occur. First of all, CNSs are now recognized in federal law under the Medicare Reimbursement Act of 1998. However, federal law regarding a particular health provider depends on state law or statute and administrative rule for scope. There is nothing in Oregon statute regarding CNS practice, and therefore, there is no way for CNSs to be recognized in Oregon, although they are recognized in 38 other states. The lack of information about CNS scope of practice in the statute has led to both underutilization of CNSs, and there may be instances of inappropriate utilization of CNSs. However, there is no way to resolve either of these problems because there are no administrative rules regarding their scope. Because there's no statute, there's no way for the Board of Nursing to resolve concerns or questions about CNS practice from health consumers, insurers, and other professionals, or to deal with people who claim to be a CNS but who lack the preparation to be one. These combined factors don't make Oregon a very good place for CNSs to practice, and consequently, few come here just because they want to practice here. However, we know that a shortage of nurses is looming on the healthcare horizon, and CNSs as master nurses are extremely important in assisting nursing staff to meet standards for nursing care during staffing shortages. getting CNSs into the Practice Act will encourage nurses to study to become CNSs and will draw CNSs to the state and potentially enable the nursing community to cope with this anticipated shortfall of nurses. In summary, HB 3000 starts the process of establishing our existence. We are supported by the Board of Nursing. You should have a letter to this effect from Debbie Burton, President of the Board of Nursing, in your hand. We are supported by the nurse practitioner community in Oregon. We are supported by our legislative sponsors, Representative Devlin and Representative Kevin Mannix, and by Senator Fortner, and by some members of the committee. We are also supported by staff nurses. Please vote HB 3000 out of committee and to the Senate floor. And now I'd like to have Maggie Donius, and then Jean Falls Wright, and then Joseph.
There you go.
Mr. Chair. Is anyone opposed to this bill?
No.
I'm going to extend that.
We can stop if you would like to.
Well, we're often to make statements, but I would say keep them brief. I'm going to enter a packet of letters here into the record, and
I'm all for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm a yes, but if we can get it done in the next 5 or 6 minutes.
We can just stop. You have copies of what all the testimony that would have been given.
Some people should
say, yeah, I better enter all
these. Yeah, because everybody wants to get on the record.
I better enter all these threatening statements. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Maggie Donius. I'm the gerontology clinical nurse specialist working at the Providence Benedictine Nursing Center in Mount Angel. I both live and work in Senator Shannon's district. I've dedicated my professional life to improving the care of frail older people. I've worked in nursing homes because I want to and because I love it, not because I couldn't get a job working someplace else. I've learned so much from engaging in this sacred work, caring for our parents and grandparents who've lived long lives. They deserve the very best we can offer in terms of health care and quality of life. My practice as a CNS is all about helping families and staff come up with ideas to meet healthcare needs satisfactorily without totally sacrificing the life the person wants to lead. My practice changes with the needs of the patients and residents on our campus, but currently the bulk of my time is spent on wound and behavioral healthcare. I assess wounds and orchestrate dressing treatments for 13 local physicians with whom we have standing orders to do so. They have communicated to me their appreciation, as most do not have expertise in this area. I also do assessments and make recommendations for mental health or behavioral symptoms experienced by our patients and residents that are referred to me by staff or family members. Our facility initiated the early efforts in physical restraint reduction, and we continue to have a least restraint philosophy. We also participated in studies to decrease the distress of bathing for persons suffering from dementia illnesses. This work has resulted in publications and presentations for other providers around the country. I want to be recognized in the Nurse Practice Act, have title protection, and provide services to patients, residents, and their families as I'm prepared to do. I hope that you will support HB 3000. Thank you.
I'm Jill Bell, and I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and you have some written testimony from Chris Wilson Nemus, who is the chair of our Nurse Executive Committee, and so I won't go into what her testimony was, but there was 2 points that they wanted me to make. One of them was that they're pleased to see that there's going to be notice of the advanced practice of master's prepared nurse, and also the other thing was that they feel that this will be an addition that they can use to assist staffing in an area while not requiring that facilities have a nurse. An example that they gave was that we would still be able to use a nurse to work in a critical care unit who she would not be required to have a master's degree, but if a facility would like to use the option of having that expanded practice, then they can have a clinical nurse specialist on their staff, and I think that's a real benefit because we're seeing patients that are more and more critical at this time. So that was the only 2 comments that they really had made.
Thank you. I'd like to go ahead and enter into the record a letter from Nancy Hodges, These are all letters of support. A letter from Carol Duncan, a letter from Ann Erbig Bush, a letter from Diane Cockburn, a letter by Daniel Sheridan, a letter by Dr. Kathleen Potenka, Professor and Dean at Oregon Health Sciences University School of Nursing, a letter by Kathleen Northrup-Schneider, a letter by Barbara Strunk from Kaiser Permanente, a letter from Jean Wright, and a letter from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, from Chris Wilson Nemes. Okay. And finally a letter from a person who has gotten service from a clinical nurse specialist, Jeff Taylor, who was also very much in support of this. So he was entered into the record. So anybody that wishes to further comment, or you just want us to vote this thing through and get going? Thank you. Close public hearing on Senate or House Bill 3000 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3000 to send to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 3000 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none? Board clerk, call the roll. Okay. I can give you this one.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Duncan has volunteered to carry House Bill 3000 on the Senate floor, so I will close the work session on House Bill 300 and open 3000, excuse me, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3130. And I'll call Wayne Shoemaker and Joe Miller. Shoemaker or Schumacher? Wayne, how do you pronounce your last name? For Schumacher. Okay, I apologize.
It's been worse.
Who are you?
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Joan Plume Miller. For the past 20 years, I have been an optometric physician in private practice in Hillsboro. I am president of the Oregon Board of Optometry, chief examiner of the National Board of Examiners in Optometry, and a clinical skills consultant to the National Board. The managed care environment has led to many changes in the delivery of health care. Practitioners of all types must strive to care for patients thoroughly and yet be maximally efficient. The time of physicians routinely spending an hour or more with every patient has passed. Having the doctor do everything from start to finish is simply too expensive a way to provide care. And yet we all want quality of care. In all health care professions today, the answer to this dilemma has been to enhance patient care by the appropriate use of ancillary personnel. Doctors rely on basic information gathered by the staff and spend their time with patients efficiently by analyzing data, doing those tests that require a higher level of skill or judgment, making a diagnosis, and providing patient education to enhance the outcome. Technology has changed virtually every field. In eye care, automated instrumentation designed to be run by staff helps physicians detect a wide range of conditions. This new equipment requires very little training and does not require physician judgment or expertise. Examples include automated lensometers that read the prescription in a pair of glasses, automated refractors, which give the doctor a good starting point to refine into a final glasses prescription, autokeratometers, which measure the curvature of the front of the eye, and automated perimeters, which check peripheral vision. Staff should be allowed to operate this equipment to gather data. With basic information, the doctor can then concentrate on tests that require a physician's skill and judgment, analyze the results, and treat the patient. Physicians should be data analysts, not just data gatherers. This bill would allow optometric physicians to supervise data gathering and use those results to diagnose and treat vision and eye health conditions. The public needs the public's need for affordable quality care would be protected. During the 8 years I have served on the Board of Optometry, three different assistant attorney generals have given the board the same advice. Our law simply does not allow a physician of any type to lend their license to a staff member. Optometric law is very restrictive. 683.020 states, in any prosecution for the violation of this section, the use of test cards, test lenses, or trial frames is prima facie evidence of the practice of optometry. Our attorneys have told us that this is the strongest possible language and that school nurses and DMV workers currently violate the law. House Bill 3130 corrects this without presenting any danger to the public. The Board of Optometry is sworn to uphold the law. Our primary mandate is to protect the public. We have not acted proactively by prosecuting nurses, the DMV, or every staff member in a medical or optometric office who ever asks someone if they can read letters on an acuity chart. However, our attorneys have made it imminently clear that if a complaint arises and there is evidence that anyone violated this section, that we must uphold the law. HB 3130 would update the law to reflect current practices across the country. The public would still be protected, but individuals who are merely acting in a data-gathering role would not be violating Oregon law. I urge members of the committee to support HB 3130 with an affirmative vote and to move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Go ahead. For the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher, Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Association, and I can't express how happy I am to address the committee on something other than Senate Bill 60. I don't know about Senator Fisher, but my beard certainly has gotten much grayer. I'm here to testify on the merits of HB 3130, which seeks to modify ORS 683.030, a portion of the statute that defines optometric practice in the state of Oregon. Simply put, Oregon optometric practice law is outdated with regards to modern methods and the use of technicians and assistants in today's busy practices. With all forms of healthcare practice, managed care has necessitated the patients be seen more efficiently than ever before. The use of staff and data gathering and some pre-testing is required so the practitioner can provide thorough yet efficient care as well as spend quality time with the patient. Additionally, it was determined while examining this issue that the vision screenings conducted by the Department of Motor Vehicles and school nurses may be considered practicing optometry according to ORS 683. While DMV does have the authority to conduct screening as allowed by ORS 807.070 based on ORS 683, only an optometrist under medical law, any medical doctor may perform those screenings. The same applies to screens provided by school nurses. What HB 3130 does is to clarify that DMV and school nurses can do vision screens without being in jeopardy of practicing optometry and to allow optometric physicians to use technicians and assistants in gathering data during eye examinations. HB 3130 does not in any way seek to expand scope of optometric practice nor change the law in any substantial way. It simply seeks to clarify the law to reflect the modern standards and address modern-day practice procedures. Our association urges the members of the Human Resource Committee to support HB 3130 and to pass it before with a due pass. Any questions?
I have a question. I hate to bring it up even, but it passed the House with a 54 vote and looks like a nice, easy bill, which I support, by the way. I only trouble with the bill. Except, as I look in the new section 3 where the word optometrist is used, I'm wondering why that wouldn't be an eye care physician, because an ophthalmologist could do the same thing. Now, you mentioned that in here. Is that understood? Or see, working under drug supervision seemed to me like it would be the same principle, wouldn't it?
Chair Fisher, Senator Duncan, you're absolutely correct. The only issue is that optometric law doesn't apply to medical practice. That's under Oregon medical law, so our change in our scope would have nothing to do with that. So we can only address what an optometrist or optometric physician would do.
Well, you mean 683 is the law that deals with
optometrists
only.
Strictly.
Okay.
So we can't deal with medical law. They already actually have that ability.
They have it already. Okay, that's better.
Yeah, that actually was a big question in the nursing home industry some years ago, 20, 25 years ago, when they started a lot of the different federal requirements and stuff, nurses were very, very hesitant to allow non-licensed people to pass meds and different things like that because all of their licenses on the line.
Okay.
And I don't remember just now how all it worked out, but there was quite a lot of work and a lot of time spent involved in getting it to where the nurses felt they were adequately protected in a situation, and we were able to operate on a basis that kept everything in perspective properly done. So I appreciate your
service. Thank you. That answers my question.
I have a question.
Senator Shannon.
So, if your eyes are examined by the technician, is that going to, and the doctors are golfing that afternoon, is that going to reduce the price of the eye exam?
No.
How's the patient going to benefit from this?
The previous input I hear on my
right. Senator Shannon, there's nothing in this bill that would allow an optometrist to go out golfing while his staff was examining the patient. We're talking about direct supervision of tasks that don't require the skill and judgment of the physician.
And the doctor's supposed to be in the office.
Direct, yes.
Okay, thanks. All right, let's...
Does that hold true for the DMV supervisor also?
Okay.
As regards to beard, I think mine's just about reached the limits of whiteness already. They have worse teeth on control.
Yeah, I see it.
That looks like that about takes care of the public testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3131, House Bill 3130. I told myself yesterday I was going to divorce myself of any Senate Bill connotations here today. So much for that. And open a work session on House Bill 3130.
Senator Fisher, I move House Bill 3130 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Shannon moves House Bill 3130 with the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Aye. I will, just the Senator Shannon wishes to carry this House Bill 3130, so I will close the work session on House Bill 3130 and open a public hearing on, I'm just going to open a work session on HJR 62. There's no one to testify, so there's no sense.
I move HJR 62 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Great.
You want the staff to read a description in here for the record?
I don't care.
You know it.
All right, it's been...
she really likes to do it. Go ahead.
There's people working on the internet. Maybe you should.
Oh, maybe you should. I'm sorry.
HJR 62 is at the request of Representative Cruz. It, too, is a piece of legislation prompted by Senate Bill 1071, which created the Task Force on Pain and Symptom Management. As you can see, Senate committee has worked the other pieces of legislation. This is the House companion bill to our SJR 28 that we passed out of committee and it went to the floor.
Okay. Senator Duncan moved that we send House Joint Resolution 62 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objections? Hearing none? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Castillo?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Do we have someone that wishes to carry this?
Sure.
Okay, Senator Shields will carry House Joint Resolution 62. With that, I'll close the work session on House Joint Resolution 62 and having no... Yes,
I think Senator Shannon made a good point that we should, we're not used to yet,
yeah.
And we need to keep in mind that there is the internet and people may be listening. We may look, we have everything in front of us, but they can't see out there,
right.
So that's a good point just to remember. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
before you leave, I want to say something. You can close the hearing. Okay. I mean, the committee, I just wanted to see some. Does that have to be on the record?
Okay. The Committee on Senate Health and Human Services is